Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Adams. In this episode, Dr. Amanda Binkley and Dr. Nimish Patel discuss pharmacist perspectives on new data from CROI 2023 and how to integrate that into clinical practice, specifically data presented on long-acting antiretroviral therapy. Dr. Binkley is a clinical pharmacy specialist in infectious diseases at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Patel is a professor in the Department of Clinical Pharmacy at Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of California in La Jolla, California. For the full online educational program, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Binkley and Dr. Patel have to say about data presented at CROI on long-acting ART.
Looking at long-acting injectable cabotegravir and rilpivirine in San Francisco's Ward 86 Safety Net Clinic, which serves publicly insured persons with HIV. Long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine was implemented using a protocol that included biweekly patient review and had significant support services that were provided to the patients. Looking at the inclusion criteria for this protocol, patients could not have any rilpivirine or INSTI mutations and had to agree to come to clinic every 4 weeks, provide their conference contact information, and receive outreach from staff. It's important to note that viral suppression was not required in this protocol. A total of 133 patients with HIV were initiated on the long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine with this protocol through June 2021 through November 2022. The baseline characteristics are here for you. As you can see, the majority had Medicaid and Medicare insurance with 98%. 8% were homeless, and about 43% or 57 of the 133 patients did have an HIV RNA level of greater than 30 copies per ml at the time of enrollment. Of those patients who had viremia, the mean HIV-1 RNA was 4.2 log, with a median CD4 count of 215 cells per millimeter cubed. Looking at the outcome for these patients who are enrolled in this long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine, 74% of patients had on-time injections. When looking at the patients who were suppressed prior to switching to long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine, there were a total of 76 patients, of which all of those patients, or 100%, maintained suppression through the follow-up period. 57 patients had viremia at baseline, and of those, 55 achieved viral suppression with a median of 33 days. Two of the patients who had the baseline viremia did have virological failure at less than 24 weeks, and upon further review, had minor mutations identified when initiating long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine. Neither of these patients achieved the 2-log drop in the HIV-1 RNA reduction by the first visit. Overall, this cohort had a virological failure rate of 1.5%, which was similar to that seen in clinical trials with a virological failure rate of 1.4% at week 48. Okay, let's talk about a patient case. We have a 44-year-old cisgender woman who is adherent to her HIV care but does not like taking antiretroviral therapy. Currently, she's prescribed a single tablet regimen and has only been suppressed during hospitalization. Her current HIV-1 RNA viral load is 37,000 copies per ml, and her CD4 count is 21. She does not have any resistance identified on genotype and has never received treatment with an NNRTI. Dr. Patel, I'd like to get your thoughts. Would you consider this patient for long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine? And if so, would you use a Q4 week or Q8 week regimen in this patient?
Good question. I think this patient, especially given the San Francisco experience, I think this patient would be a good candidate for long-acting cab and rilpivirine. My only concern is whether or not they could be adherent to their clinic visits, because it's one thing to be adherent to a medication that you have to take at home, but there does require a bit of coordination for the injections and coming to clinic. So I think that would probably be my biggest concern with this patient, just making sure that they could come to their visits. And then I think the second part of your question was Q4 versus Q8. Just knowing that there is the possibility that they would potentially miss a clinic visit, I think one of the things that I would probably do is start off on Q4 and knowing that there's a bit of flexibility if they're late with their injections, at least it falls within that Q8 window.
That sounds great. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, one of the things I think I would do here too is a shared decision making with the patient and talking to her to see, you know, and I think this is a great opportunity for pharmacists is to see what barriers exist and why she's not able to adhere to the oral medications. And I agree with you. I think, you know, definitely consider a long-acting cabotegravir or piperine for this patient and see, you know, making sure she did be adherent to the visits, like you said. Were there any support systems that you would want to ensure were in place to optimize her success on this regimen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are support systems that are based out of the clinic, which I think the pharmacist is really well positioned to send reminders and contact the patient when visits are coming up. But also from a patient perspective, I think utilizing technology, like there's an app for everything these days. So downloading those apps that remind you when your visits are to just make sure that you don't miss them.
I think that's great. That's a great idea. You know, most people have a cell phone now. And so figuring out what apps we can use and utilizing that to help our patients, I think is a great idea. Okay. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Patel to move on to talk about the SOLAR study.
Excellent. Okay. So the SOLAR study was a randomized trial that looked at adults who were on bictegravir, FTC, and TAF, who were undetectable for at least 6 months and were randomized to one of three treatment arms. So to continue on bictegravir, FTC, TAF daily, and then one of two long-acting cabotegravir, rilpivirine treatment arms. So the first arm had an oral lead-in and the other one did not have an oral lead-in, but both of them were administered Q2 months. After 12 months, so this was considered the maintenance phase of the SOLAR study. And after 12 months, all of the participants entered the extension phase, which everyone received long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine every 2 months. The primary endpoint was the proportion of patients who had a detectable viral load at 12 months. And other outcomes that were evaluated were the incidence of confirmed virologic failure, safety and tolerability, and treatment satisfaction. And when you look at the virologic outcomes, they're very inspiring here. Very few people had a virologic non-response. Most people who were randomized to either long-acting cabotegravir or rilpivirine or bictegravir FTC-TAV, most of them achieved an undetectable viral load. Like in most trials of this nature, there were a small subset of people who just had no virologic data available. But when you look at the treatment difference between the two treatments, the treatments were considered non-inferior when looking at the outcome of achieving a virologic non-response, as well as achieving an undetectable viral load. So both of those outcomes met the non-inferiority margin. In terms of INSTIs, we oftentimes are concerned about weight changes and metabolic changes. And the SOLAR study did evaluate this. And compared to bictegravir FTC-TAF, long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine recipients had similar changes in weight over the 12-month study period. Where there was a bit of movement was when looking at the categorization of people based on their BMI. And in those people who were entering the study with a normal BMI, so a BMI between 20 and 24.9, the study looked at how many of them moved into the next BMI category, which would be overweight. So it looked like numerically there was a higher proportion of bictegravir FTC-TAF recipients who made that shift from a normal BMI to an overweight BMI. And then in those individuals who started the study in the overweight BMI category, it looked like there's a similar proportion of patients between bictegravir FTC-TAF and long-acting cabotegravir rilpivirine that moved into the obese category. In terms of changes to hip or waist circumference or other metabolic parameters that were evaluated, there was no clinically relevant changes that were observed between baseline and month 12.
Thank you very much to Dr. Binkley and Dr. Patel, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full Contemporary HIV Treatment and Prevention 2023 program on the Clinical Care Options website, and to access the slide set for integrating new data from CROI 2023 Pharmacist Perspectives, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. Please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you and have a great day.